is made possible with support from Verde Gallery, currently showing Alchemy and the Stones of Brittany, sculptures and encaustic paintings by Tony Putnam. Also featuring a bluegrass jam every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. and tango on September 25th at 8 p.m. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom featuring hundreds of unique magazines at 17 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at www.verdant-systems.com. Be inspired. Funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution in honor of Joan Friedman and Charles Blair on the occasion of their anniversary, and also in honor of Fred Day and Henry Day.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Celeste Quinn is away. I'm Tom Rogers. And we have a unfortunately infrequent but a continuing series that we have on the Afternoon Magazine discussing current issues in journalism. And with us to do that is right now the Dean of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois, Ron Yates. And welcome to our program again, Ron.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be back.
Nice to see you again. It's been a few months since we've done one of these shows.
It has.
And what we want to do is discuss some of the top issues in the field of journalism. And there probably isn't a better time or a more contentious time to talk about journalism topics than right now in the heat of a political battle that's caused some fallout already, even before any votes are cast, before the presidential election coming up in November. Also, other issues. Post 9/11 journalism, the rise of technology and new ways of getting stories out to the public, also taking up a lot of discussion time. And discussion is what we'd like to have on this show. We'd like to hear your calls. Give us a call at 333-WILL if you're in the Champaign-Urbana coverage area. The local phone area. And outside the area, 1-800-222-WILL. That translates to 9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Before becoming the Dean of the College of Communications this year, Ron Yates was the head of the journalism department at the U of I, and before that had a long distinguished career as a journalist with the Chicago Tribune. And he joins us, as mentioned, to talk about issues in the field. One thing that that is the top story today, apparently, is the decision by CBS News and Dan Rather that the evidence that they had used in a story on George W. Bush's National Guard record cannot be authenticated as true. Obviously, it's a story that's going to have some very big waves on any number of levels.
It will. You know, I think the main question that pops in my mind when I see this mea culpa today on the part of Dan Rather is, why did they go with that story in the first place if they didn't have this nailed down? And to me, that's a problem that seems endemic in some ways in the world of journalism, that there is always the pressure of time and the pressure of deadline, and you're always trying to get that story out there first. And in so doing, you have a tendency not to be as careful examining the facts as you should. And in this particular case, I don't know, you know, there are a lot of accusations flying around about the reasons why this story was done. And one of them, obviously, it was done by CBS, was trying to bring down the president. Another one, it was just sloppy journalism. And I tend to think it's more the latter than the former, because I don't think anybody makes a conscious decision that we're talking about to, okay, let's bring down the president. But I do think that there's a serious problem in how that story was vetted. And I do question then the reasons why they went with the story when they didn't have it completely validated or verified.
How do you define authentication? How do you verify something like that? And the background, obviously, being that these were supposedly documents written or typed by National Guard personnel back in the early 70s during George Bush's tour of duty.
Well, I think in this particular case, after the stories, or perhaps even before the stories broke, there were a couple of people, experts at CBS, had consulted, and they warned CBS about going with this, saying that there were problems with the memos. And of course, then we know that the the story was picked up by all the internet bloggers, and now we know that they were saying that the Times New Roman font and superscript letters over a TH in the 11th Squadron appeared to have come from a word processor and not from a period typewriter 30 years ago.
Right.
And so to me, that says, uh-oh, what's going on here? Now, it's quite possible that the original documents could have been scanned into a computer program and then they just altered the font. You know, that's one explanation, I guess. But to me, that raises a red flag.
And there had been a lot of – I mean, once the story broke, there were – typewriting experts from all over the place that had given differing – and their responses to this were all over the place as well. Some said, mm-hmm. no, it couldn't possibly have been typewritten back in the early 70s. Some said, yes, you could get something like that. I mean, once you get into the question of authenticating or verifying something, how do you have to digest all that possibly conflicting information you get from the so-called experts?
Well, I think it takes more than one individual to make those decisions, and I don't know how much of the decision-making process was unilaterally done by Dan Rather or if there were a group of people who were working on this story. But ultimately, if you are the reporter, and in this case, I guess Dan Rather is the reporter, then you are ultimately responsible for it because it's your name on it. And it's the same thing that happened with the Tailwind scandal with CNN several years ago, in which Peter Arnett, though he didn't report the story, didn't produce them, his name was on it, so he was ultimately held responsible and naturally ultimately resigned from CNN over it. But this particular story, this is not the first time that CBS has gotten itself into a little bit of trouble. You know, back in 1982, Dan Rather did a story in which he interviewed 8 Vietnam veterans who claimed to know about personal knowledge of atrocities committed in Vietnam during General Westmoreland's watch, and those stories were eventually shown. Well, actually, 3 of the so-called Vietnam veterans had never been in Vietnam, and the others had never been in the combat zone. So right away, the stories were discredited, and ultimately, what had to happen is CBS had to reach an out-of-court settlement with General Westmoreland, and they paid him several million dollars. We don't know how much, but it was done out of court.
CBS was obviously embarrassed by that story,
right,
but didn't suffer extreme consequences, I guess. What happens at this point?
No, I mean, and Dan Rather, his career stayed intact, and he became an anchor. And I think at this point, I don't know if I were running CBS, I think the credibility of the network is at stake now, and I think that especially given this really heated presidential campaign in which all these character issues are flying around and a lot of unsubstantiated data flying around through the airwaves, I think if I were Dan Rather, I think at this point in my career I might think about stepping down, but it's up to him, and or he might wind up being fired, over this. This is really a significant black mark on CBS's credibility.
We'd like to hear your comments and questions for Ron Yates. Our number 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller now on line one on a cell phone. Good afternoon, caller.
Hello. Back to CBS's verification, the superscript, subscript, all that kind of crap. New Times Roman was invented in 1931. So as a typeface, that's been around for a while. Throw that issue out. MS Word, which was accused of being the program to that may be able to duplicate the fonts and all that kind of stuff, was designed to duplicate an IBM Selectric typewriter, the most popular typewriter around. Throw that out. Get back to superscript, subscripts. I had an Underwood typewriter back in the 60s, manual, that would do subscripts and superscripts. You can throw that out. All these things were just red herrings. The most important thing was that some blogger came on at like 8:59, even before CBS had finished their broadcast, to accuse them of some sort of perfidy there. Any comment?
Well, I think the larger question here is what has happened today, and that is Dan Rather himself admitting that the stories were not verifiable and that they shouldn't have done them. So, to me, that says a lot about the credibility of the whole reporting and the stories that were broadcast as they were broadcast.
Mm-hmm. And they were pointing out various little pixelizations of some of the characters. when they've been copied and faxed and typed and, well, faxed, copied, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, there's going to be little errors and bits missing here and there out of typefaces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's just, you might be correct. I don't know. I'm not a, you know, a font specialist, but I think that, you know, the fact that these were issues that were pointed out, it just kind of led everybody to think more about the way these stories were vetted. And, of course, now we know, as I say, CBS today announcing that they apologize essentially for doing the stories and saying that they were not verifiable. So to me, that's the larger issue, and that's the most important one, so to date at least.
Did any of that story discount the fact that Bush walked out on his duty, or did it discount any of that he wasn't observable for 6 months to a year at a time? I don't think that addressed the concern at all, so we still have an AWOL president.
No, I don't know if that's verifiable either. I mean, where's the proof of that? There's nothing there that says he didn't do this.
There's been offers out for $10,000 for anybody from Alabama who can come up and say, yes, I was there, I served with him, and that hasn't been taken.
Well, I don't know. There are people who have come on television to say they were with him. So
that guy who came on and said he was there served in the summer, and Bush wasn't due in that squadron until the fall, so his recollections are obviously tainted.
Well, see, I think this is the problem with this presidential campaign, number one. I think the character issue has gotten way out of whack, and that's not the issues that we should be talking about, either Bush or Kerry, and what Kerry did in Vietnam or didn't do in Vietnam, what medals he won or didn't win, and what Bush did in the National Guard 30 years ago. To me, it's irrelevant. I mean, I think right now, I mean, when Clinton was president, he went off to Oxford to get out of the draft from going to Vietnam. So people, you know, people have done things when they were younger that they may not be proud of today. But the real issue here is, in this campaign, are the issues that we should be looking at. That is, you know, Iraq, the economy, things like that. And we're getting sidetracked by all these peripheral issues, which are not really that important in my mind.
I'll grant you they're peripheral. But the whole reason why they go back that far is because there's a pattern of deceit on this president going back that far.
Well, I don't know that to be a fact.
Back to his drunken college days, back to his falsified records, back to his claiming to be in the Air Force when he first ran for Congress. All the way through his presidency, he's claimed one thing, done another. And to establish a pattern, you start as far back as possible, and you show this guy punches a rugby player illegally in the face. That was in his yearbook. You go back and you find as much evidence about all the things, and then you establish a pattern. It's just that simple.
Well, I don't think it's that simple. I think there's a lot more that we have to be looking at in terms of a person's ability to serve as president, and that is the kind of decisions that he's making now and the kinds of things he's going to be doing in the future to deal with these very significant issues that we're facing. And I think that, you know, whether it's Kerry or Bush, you have to look at what they've done more recently than what they did when they were, you know, a lot of us did a lot of stupid things when we were young, you know, and you regret them maybe now, but they shouldn't keep you from becoming what you are today, you know.
And with that, we'll thank you for your call. We have other people holding on the line right now. Let's go to line two now. Caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I'm calling just to see if this would be if Dan Rather had the benefit of 2020 hindsight, could he, consistent with journalistic honesty, have presented this story? And I always had the impression that the documents were sort of the icing on the cake, that there were other elements of this story, as Dan Rather constantly stated, that went to the heart of it, including maybe Secretary Knox's statement that these were false documents, but that's what my boss, the colonel, thought of George W. Bush's service. Could Rather have presented these documents as something that he could not vouch for their authenticity, because I think that is well nigh impossible, but which are consistent with the rest of the story, and which, as reported, we at CBS, including myself, could not ignore in light of the nature of this presidential campaign?
That's a very good comment, very good question. I think what should be done in any situation, whether it's this or anything else, when you're reporting a story and you don't have everything nailed down 100%, then it's incumbent upon you as a reporter to say in the story, this is what we know so far. This is what we are able to verify. There are some areas we're not able to verify yet. These are the questions which still remain. We're working on those. And rather than just to come out and say, we know this to be a fact, and then get yourself hung up like they did, I think that your point is well taken, that you need to make sure that you cannot present a story as fact if you don't have everything nailed down. And there's nothing wrong in doing a story and saying, look, reader, or look, listener, or viewer, this is what we know right now. There are holes. We're working on those. But this is what we know right now. We think it's significant enough that we need to put it out there for your, for you to look at. You know, and then you have to stand by it, of course, and you have to continue to do the reporting to nail down the areas that you haven't done thus far. Whether or not you do it may be difficult, but I think that's what you should be doing.
Okay. Well, thank you.
And thank you for your call. Line 3 we go to right now. Another caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yes, thank you. Well, yeah, I'd like to see the Bush administration being held to the same standards that everybody else seems to be. I mean, they let the president and the vice president get away with making, statements that would suggest that somehow Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, that, Cheney still will make references to weapons of mass destruction being, that Saddam had those and all kinds of stuff like that, and they just let that stuff fly by. And the other thing that I find really annoying about the media is this, sort of warped idea of what they consider objectivity and fairness or balance to be, where, the analogy has been made that if the Bush administration came out and said the world is flat and, somebody else comes and says, well, no, the world is not flat, it's a sphere, they would have a situation where they say, well, on one side, Bush administration thinks that the world is flat and other people think that the world is a sphere. Opinions vary, We can't make up our mind about this. That's just the way it is.
Well, that's true. I think that a lot of what we're seeing here is, once again, it's almost endemic. We're involved in 24-hour news cycles. The pressure to produce, to report, to present is incredibly intense. The networks are battling the 24-hour cable networks, who often beat them on every story that's out there. So obviously, if you're Dan Rather, you're trying to deal with your ratings questions. You're trying to figure out you're trying to do a story that nobody else has, and steal the thunder from the cable networks. I think what happens is we rush sometimes to judgment. We rush the story in before it's ready to go, and I think that results in the kinds of problems we're seeing right now. And I don't know if you want to get into the what Bush or what Cheney are both saying about weapons of mass destruction, or what Saddam Hussein did or did not have to do with 9/11. I think that nobody at this point, maybe we'll find out what Saddam Hussein had to do with 9/11, if anything, during his trial, which is coming up pretty soon. We'll find more out about that perhaps at that point. But to me, I think this is a problem that I'm thinking journalistically now. It's a journalistic problem in how we need to be a lot more thoughtful in how we present information and the context in which we present it.
Well, I would direct you to the 9/11 Commission report if you want to talk about, whether evidence there is there for, some connection to Saddam Hussein and 9/11. But I would say this in closing that, if you held the Fox supposed news channel to the same standard that you're holding CBS to, they'd be making a mea culpa every day, if not every 15 minutes. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Thanks for your comment. That does bring up, in fact, I believe there was a Chicago Tribune article over the weekend about, the objectivity of news and whether we are getting another definition of objectivity and fairness and balance with the fact that there's so many media out there now that people have a chance to look at the news based on their political views.
Right.
And whether, you know, people, you know, news operations are now considering it a business decision as much as anything to possibly add opinion to their newscasts.
Well, it's almost like we've gone back into, you know, maybe 200 years ago or 150 years ago, and we had pamphleteers, you know, who would write their stories or their commentaries with a certain bias built in, because that was the view they were trying to, you know, they were trying to get across to readers. I believe that where we are getting into some trouble now is this very fuzzy, strange blending of information and entertainment. And we are beginning to find this new word, infotainment, a little bit of news, a little bit of entertainment. Where does the entertainment begin? Where does the news end, et cetera? I think these are all questions that the media have to be thinking about, and they need to be thinking about how to one thing that the mainstream media can do that the bloggers and that the internet folks and Matt Drudge and people like that cannot do is the mainstream media still have a very powerful function in this society, and that is to be a filter for a lot of that strange information that's flying around the internet. I mean, to be a filter for news, to actually vet it in a way that, say, that we've run this through our filter a lot, and we now know that this part is true, the rest of it we're not quite sure about. But when you go on the internet, be prepared and be ready to understand the old, you know, the old Latin phrase, caveat emptor, you know, the buyer beware, because you're going to, you know, you're going to get a lot of junk on the internet, that's for sure.
But some are questioning, is there a market for that anymore with the growth that these other types of sites are seeing as compared to, you know, fairly stable subscription levels of some of the major news magazines, the, you know, long-running newspapers. Network television news is down fairly substantially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you try to keep it from becoming a business decision, I guess?
Well, I think it's cyclical. I believe that what will happen, I think most people out there want to know that when they're reading something or watching it, that it's true, that it's as true as it can possibly be, that it's been verified and vetted the way it should be. I don't think that yes, all of us will go on the internet and we'll see all kinds of weird and strange stories and rumor and gossip about this or that, and yeah, it's and some of it may support a particular a political view and whatever you may believe, right or left, mainstream, middle of the road, whatever. But I think that there is a place still for news that has been properly processed and researched and then and organized in a way and still written and presented compellingly, but which is accurate. And I think that is the key. Most people, maybe they will go through this cyclical phase where they'll be looking at these websites. They'll be interested in what they're having to say, but then they'll begin to understand it's not really verifiable. Then they'll go back to a source which does verify the information. I think that is still going to be a market.
We'd like to hear your comments and questions for Ron Yates, the Dean of the College of Communication, a long journalistic career as well behind him. The number is 217-333-333. WILL in the Champaign-Urbana area, just 333-WILL, or outside 1-800-222-WILL, and you can call that number toll-free. You mentioned blogs, and that's one of the mm-hmm. newest you know, types of information disseminating formats out there. Independent people who, you know, it may not have been involved in writing of any kind before, can go online, can offer their what they feel that they've found, offer their opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've really come across a non-opinionated blog yet.
No.
And people follow it, and that is, in fact, where a lot of the initial energy began when people started questioning the CBS documents.
Well, I think as an internet user, and if you're looking at these blogs, I think it's incumbent upon you as the user to ask yourself, where did this person get this information, and how did they verify it, and is it true, and what is their agenda? You know, and I think that the answer to those questions are going to be probably the person got the information from somebody else who got it from somebody else who got it from somebody else. And it's just been cycled through the Internet to the point where it becomes fact because it's been cycled through the Internet. It's like there are a lot of places on the Internet where you can go to check out this stuff. You know, there are these special websites that will help you understand if a story is an urban legend or if it's actually fact, you know. And what you find is a lot of the garbage that comes flying through the Internet is just garbage. It's exactly what it is. It's not true. It's just been created by somebody, and it becomes truth because, you know, there's a Japanese saying, one dog barks and 10,000 others pass it on as truth. You know, and that's that to me, that's what we're seeing here with bloggers.
How long does it take for stuff like that to become fact or fiction or debunked? I mean, you know, the documents that we're talking about, mm-hmm. the cycle was very quick. I mean, even as if I believe the first caller, that the discussion began even before the story aired.
Right. Well, I think it happens this way. I think if you're seeing things on the Internet, stories or whatever, that fit into your definition of truth, then that's what you compartmentalize in your mind, or that's what you cut and paste and put into your own file, or whether it's electronic or hard copy, and that because that reinforces what you believe. And we all want to believe that we know the truth, and somebody else may not. And so what you do is you load up on all this information, which seems to, I guess it's just a case of numbers. You know, it's the old advertising. We learned in logic class that, you know, 50 smoke camels, 50,000 Frenchmen can't be wrong or something like that. You know, yes, they can. Yes, they can be wrong. So that's what you have to do. It's really you have to be your own best editor, and you have to look at this stuff with a certain amount of skepticism, because believe me, if you don't, and you start believing a lot of this, you're going to be making decisions based on a lot of spurious information. And to me, that is a very dangerous thing.
We have a call now on line one in Urbana for Ron Yates. Good afternoon, line one.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. I think that credibility is the most important thing here, and credibility is built on time and trust. And once you have that time to get verification of something you've been told, then you build that trust, and once that trust is built, it becomes more believable. And I think NPR and your station here has done that, and that's one of the reasons that I listen to it. And I hope sincerely that NPR doesn't weaken to the pressures of the Fox networks and so forth, and go into this
infotainment.
Infotainment. I hope they don't fall into that. And the reason, sometimes we demand people do that. You know, we kind of like to have our own ideas verified, and even though we know sometimes it's not true, but I think that's part of the I was listening to Quinn. What's her name? I can't think of her name. Your announcer.
Celeste Quinn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Celeste Quinn. And she had a guy on there that a producer had gotten who was a very controversial fellow, and he got on there, and then he wouldn't let anyone respond, and they started shouting at one another, like the shout things you see on TV. And they were yelling and shouting back and forth, and nobody, and it was just offensive to me. And then some guy called in and said, well, yeah, this is the best program I've ever heard. Good, keep up the good work. I thought it was probably the worst program I'd heard, and the producer should have checked out who they were putting on the air ahead of time if that was the type of individual.
Shows how large a market we're dealing with, I guess. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks.
I think I think you have the trust. You have the trust. You have the confidence, and you've built it over time, NPR and locally WILL. And I think you need to stay with it. Don't let these pressures change your way. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Thanks for the compliment.
Right. Thank you very much. And I don't think you have to worry about that. I think one of the we have standards, holding ourselves to a high standard of credibility is a critical thing for any, you know, for any news outlet and for any news organization. And if you let that slip, if you slide and you begin to, as you point out, lose your credibility, to me, that's all a journalist has. I mean, if you don't have your credibility, you have nothing. And that's why it's very important for journalists to be very careful about what they write, what they print, what they publish, what they broadcast, because their name is on it. And when you've lost that trust, lost that credibility, you've lost everything in this business.
And Henry Frayne, our technical director, just reminded me offline that it was Nat Hentoff was the interviewee on that show that Celeste Quinn did a few weeks ago. I remember that myself. Here's another piece of evidence, or at least a demonstration in what we've been talking about, how you clear a story, how you decide to run with a story, even if you may have sources that may not be completely verifiable. The AP right now is running a story with an urgent banner saying that a website is claiming that Iraqi militants have beheaded one of the American hostages in Iraq. There were two Americans and a Briton who were being held. And it says the claim has not been verified. And you go into the second part of the story. The statement said a group led by Abu Masab al-Zarqawi would now be head the others. Two Americans and a Briton were kidnapped last week in Baghdad. A video was released Saturday by a militant group stating it'll kill the men if the U.S. doesn't release all Iraqi women being held at two prisons by today. So that has just come over the wire in the last minute or so. But at the Associated Press, a lot of this discussion that we're talking about is taking place at this very moment.
Absolutely.
In whether or not to put that story out.
Right. And they're saying it's not verifiable yet.
Right.
Right. So – to me, that's the responsible thing to do. If you don't know something to be a fact, you're not for sure that it's a fact, then please don't put it out as fact. I think that the news business has come a long way in the last 25 or 30 years. I got into this business 30 years ago, right out of college, and I know at that time there was nothing in the Chicago Tribune that allowed you to do a clary, or in other words, a clarification, to say, oh, this was wrong, we're sorry about that. We had no public editor, somebody who actually interfaced or actually dealt with the public. We were very arrogant. We put it in. It's true. You like it or you lump it, And over time, we began to learn that if you're going to keep this credibility, you've got to be able to show that you are willing to step up and admit your mistakes and say, this is what we didn't do right. This is what we know to be correct. We're sorry we made the mistake. And then you go ahead. And I think that's paid dividends for the Tribune and other news organizations. Even the New York Times, it just created a public editor after the Jason Blair fiasco.
But when it comes right down to it, you've got a certain amount of information and you have to decide whether or not to run with it,
right?
Even if you do place that disclaimer on there saying this hasn't been verified.
Right.
Because a lot of times, especially the listening audience, where you only have one shot at hearing something, will say they beheaded that guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
but
true.
But we don't know. Let's go on to a line 4 in Douglas County. Good afternoon. Let's get him on the line. There we go. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I want to, if we're better than we were 25 years ago, we were in a mess 25 years ago. My own feeling is we've gone way downhill. I think the state of the media today is just really damned lousy. You look at the mainstream media, and now there are a few mea culpas coming out from the Post and the Times on the build-up to the war saying, oops, we just repeated what the administration wanted us to, and we were wrong. It is so rare that they admit their huge, huge mistakes. The media was complicit in the last election cycle 4 years ago. They bought a storyline, and they're doing it again. You see the same thing. They've adopted a persona. This is the Bush persona, strong, resolute, never wavers, never changes his mind, and everything is cast in those terms. The Kerry storyline is he's a flip-flopper. Everything he does is cast in those terms. You did it 4 years ago with Gore.
Which papers were you reading? Because I'm not getting that impression this time around.
I read the New York Times. I read the Washington Post online.
But do you think the New York Times is – you believe the New York Times is anti-Kerry?
I think the New York Times is guilty of fostering a storyline about the candidate and interpreting everything that the candidates, both candidates, do in terms of that storyline. Indeed, I do. I know that editorially, if you look at the editorials, the New York Times, don't recall, but I'm sure that they probably do endorse Kerry. But if you look at the storyline that the reporters are following, you know, you can read a campaign event, and it was really strong 4 years ago with the debates. The reporters are a bunch of PAC journalists. I mean, they have a range of opinion from A to B. And it's true that there's tons of garbage on the Internet, but if you wanted to find out, for example, in the build-up to the war, what was really going on and the strength of the evidence of the UN inspectors and so on against the line of the Bush administration, you couldn't get it in the mainstream media. The only place you could get it was on the Internet. And now, belatedly, the New York Times has said, well, we sort of dropped the ball. You know, it turns out that the only people who had it right were the people that had the least credibility, according to mainstream media, and that was the UN weapons inspectors. This morning, NPR, this is on a different issue slightly, too often what counts as journalism is you get spokesmen from the two camps who go head-to-head, and so you let them contradict each other, and as a previous caller said, you know, one side will say the world is flat, and the other will say the world is round, and so you let them each make their claim.
That's not journalism.
Well, but this morning, there was an NPR story. They had the former spokesman for the U.S. interim government in Iraq on, and somebody from the Kerry administration. And each of them were saying things that were totally outrageous. And so the interviewer sort of lets them do it, and then that's the end of the story. Journalism, to me, is, you know, the journalist is supposed to know the backstory. And when somebody says something outrageous, is to point out, well, da-da-da-da-da-da.
You're talking about, right? Those are good points. What you're talking about, however, is if you're talking about a broadcast show, which is what you are talking about, then that is very good radio or very good television because you've got two people talking about a particular issue. Good journalism begins, however, when a reporter begins to check into what those two people are saying and begins to make sense out of what they're saying and begins to you know, look at which side or where the truth lies in both of these statements, and then you begin to lay out some kind of an interpretive analysis of that whole issue. That is where journalism begins, you know, and I think that's what's missing when you have the talking heads yelling at one another on television or radio, because you're right, you're not getting – that's not journalism. That's just two people arguing. I can go to a bar and have the same kind of hear the same kind of arguments.
The NPR interviewer ought not to be interviewing if they're not able to directly challenge when someone says something that obviously contradicts official government documents.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I think what you're trying to do, though, is allow people to air these issues in a public forum and then take the issues that have been laid out there and then begin to dig deeper to find out where the truth lies. I don't think you can do that if you don't let people talk in a public forum. See, and you're getting people to talk behind closed doors on deep background is one thing, but getting them to come out in public and say something, that's something else. And but it's incumbent upon journalism per se to go after these stories in a much more in-depth way than just say, well, there you have it. That's the news for the day, you know.
I'm not opposed to direct interviews, but, you know, in the morning, listen to the BBC feed that comes on at what time, 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
You'll hear the BBC interviewer, in response to something outrageous from a government spokesman, say, you know, you expect me to believe, and then they will give the back fact that is out there that directly contradicts what he said. And so the interviewer, rather than simply asking polite questions and not providing any sort of context or background, listen to the BBC. Their interviewers are quite aggressive, and they're knowledgeable and informed, and they don't let anybody make outrageous statements without saying, you know, well, this is what your government said, you know, last week, or here's this document that directly contradicts what you're saying. And our journalists don't want to do that. I think it's because
Well, I wouldn't paint them all with the same brush.
Cozy. Well,
I wouldn't paint them all. I mean, I don't like to generalize. I think that there are an awful lot of very good journalists in this country who are doing exactly what you're talking about. You may not have seen them or heard them, but they are doing that kind of work. And I know a lot of them myself. So
give me a list of people I ought to be paying attention to, because I'm having a hard time finding them in the mainstream media. So, you know, give me some guidelines. Who's out there that's doing great work?
Well, I mean, if to run off a litany of names, I'm not sure if I can even do that. But I know that there are
one or two.
Pardon me?
One or two.
Well, I mean, you've got people at the. I'm just if you're looking at the New York Times, there are very good reporters who are doing good investigative reporting. There are people at the Chicago Tribune who do good investigative reporting. You've got people like, you know, local reporters up in Chicago who work hard. One of my faculty members, Bill Gaines, won 2 Pulitzer Prizes for doing investigative reporting, and he's still doing that kind of work, even on my faculty here. So there are people out there who really take this work seriously and are, you know, are doing exemplary work, but not all of them. You know, I mean, obviously you're going to find in any profession, you're going to find mediocre practitioners, and that just happens.
Thanks for your call.
Sure.
Let's go very quickly. We just have a couple of minutes left, and we do have one more line waiting. We'll try to get him in. Line 1 in Champaign, good afternoon.
Hi, is that me?
That would be you.
Yes. Okay, I just wanted to bounce off a theory off of you about this fiasco with Dan Rather. Now, he's a pretty experienced reporter, and it just seems incredible that he got himself into such a mess over something like that. And the rapidity with which the bloggers came out of the closet to respond to that thing is just mind-boggling, and it really looks to me like he was set up. That is to say, somebody in the Bush campaign or the Bush administration fabricated those false documents, fed them to him, and then pounced on them as soon as they aired. And I just wonder what you think about that. And I guess I also wonder if there's a history of that kind of thing happening in other campaigns in the past that you know of.
Well, I don't think that that's the case in this particular case. I just don't believe that. But I will say this: there is a history of governments, and not just our own, and not just this particular administration. I mean, you can go all the way back to the Civil War, of trying to manipulate the media any way they possibly can to get their story out, to get what they want out there. Now, somebody, a previous caller, said, well, the reporters listened to what the administration said and printed what it wanted them to say. That's not exactly the truth. What they did, they might have listened to the information and they printed what the government said, but they didn't. Maybe they didn't do the kind of fact checking or the reporting they needed to do to see if what was being said it was 100% accurate. In other words, they you cannot take anything at face value. I mean, I never did as a reporter. If somebody told me, if somebody from the State Department said, this is what we're going to be doing, this is what's happening here, then I would go to other places. I would go to other sources, other embassies, if I was working as a foreign correspondent, which is what I did. And I would check with other embassies about that particular story to find out what their take was on it. And somewhere in that whole morass information, I began to arrive at what I thought was the truth. And so it's incumbent upon the reporter then to be responsible for the information that he or she presents. And in this case, what is Dan Rather saying? He's saying that he was misled, and he's sorry for that. We made a mistake in judgment, and for that I'm sorry, he said. I find we have been misled on the key question of how our source for the documents came into possession of these papers. And to me, that that's taking responsibility for not doing the kind of reporting that Dan Rather is known for.
Thank you for your time. And with this brief amount of time we have left, let me just pose one last question. How are students digesting all of this, you think? And how is, you know, how are the events surrounding, you know, journalism today going to change the crop of journalists, future journalists, as opposed to the people who are in the business now?
Well, I mean, what I tell students is that they have an awesome responsibility when they're out there working professionally. When they're out there dealing with people's lives and dealing with information that can have a tremendous impact on our society and on the decision-making processes, then they have a great responsibility to make sure that what they're doing is accurate. And if it's not, then don't do it. If you cannot vet something or verify it, don't write it, don't publish it.
Ron Yates, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Ron Yates is the dean of the University of Illinois College of Communication and the former head of the journalism department at UI Urbana-Champaign. It is 9 minutes now before 2 o'clock.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
While many other radio stations have eliminated or severely cut back on the agricultural service they provide, WILL has made an even stronger commitment to our ag services. This is Les Schulte, Director of Corporate Support. If this information is important to your business and customers, consider supporting this station with your dollars. Call 217-333-0850 for more information on the business programs available for you.
And at 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, a look at the closing market numbers. And with the closing numbers from the Board of Trade, we go to Todd Gleason in the Ag Office. Good afternoon, Todd.
Thank you very much, Tom. This afternoon at the Board of Trade, corn futures were lower. This for the seventh consecutive day where they made new contract lows as seasonal harvest pressure putting some downside into that market as well as into the soybeans. Wheat futures were lower today as well. They were following the Minneapolis Grain Exchange and I think the Winnipeg Grain Exchange lower in the wheat pit. December futures for the day, 333, the high in the wheat pit, the low at 325. A settlement price there at 328 and three quarters. They were off 4.5 cents at the end of the day. The March contract, 3.75 lower, 343 was the high. The low at 336.5 settled at 340. May contract in the wheat pit, 346 the high, the low at 341.5 settled 344.5 down 3.75. In July futures, 348 the high, low at 343, settlement price at 345.5, and they were down 3.5 cents for the day. From the corn pit, the nearby December contract, 215 the high, the low at 212.5. That's a new contract low. Settled a quarter cent above that at 212.75, down 2.5 cents. March futures, 225 high, low at 222.5. Settled at 222.75, down 2.5 cents. And the May corn, 231.75, the high, the low at 229.5. Settled 229.5, down on that low. 2.5 cents lower for the day. July futures, 236.75 high, low at 234.75, settled 235. They were off 2 cents. And September corn for next year, 242.25 the high, the low at 240. Settlement price there at 240, down 2.5 cents. Next year's DEES contract, 248.5 high, low at 246.75. Red December settled 247.25. They were off 1.5 cents for the day. December oats, 165.75, the high, the low at 162.5. Settlement price at 164, penny and a half lower. And the March contract, down 2 cents for the day. A high of 170.25, a low at 168.5, settled at 169. From the soy complex now, nearby November beans, 548 the high, the low at 542.5, settlement price at 543.75, and they were down 9.25 cents for the day. January futures, 550.75 the high, 550.75 the settlement price, down 9.75 for that January contract, the high at 556, a low at 550, settled once again at 550.75 in the Jan contract, down 9.75 cents. March futures in the bean pit, 563 high, low at 557.5. Settlement price, 558.75, 8.5 lower. The May futures were down 9.5 at the end of the day, had a high at 569, a low at 565, and settled on net low at 565. July soybeans, 575 the high, the low at 570, settled a penny above that at 571, down 9 cents. And the Novembers were off 8 at the end of the day. They settled at 568 with a high of 573 and a low at 567. October bean meal for the day, 162.60 the high, the low at 161.30, settled 161.80. They finished the day down 160. And the December bean meal, 164.80 the high, the low at 163.10, settled at 163.40. They were down 2 for the day. October bean oil at 22.08 the high, the low at 21.75, settled 21.71. That penny, or 77 rather, down 31 for the day. And the December bean oil, 21.75 the high, the low at 21.55, a settlement price there at 21.62. And they were down 27 at the end of the day. At 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock, I'll be back with the closing market report this afternoon. It is National Farm Safety and Health Week. Be sure to tune in at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock for the closing market report all week long. We'll be talking about harvest season safety. On the studio, in the studio rather, now with us is Jay Pierce to take a look at what happened at the Mercantile Exchange. Jay?
Well, thank you very much, Todd. Prices up on the close of the Mercantile Exchange today. The September feeder cattle had a high of 115.30, a low of 114.90, the settlement 115.20, up 55. October feeder cattle, 113.35 for the high, 112.15, the low, 112.80 was the settlement today, up 90. And the November feeder cattle had a high today of 112.40, a low of 110.35, the settlement 112 even, up 197 and a half. Live cattle for October, high today, 86.40, the low 85.30, the settlement 86 even, up 55. And December live cattle, the high today, 89.05, the low was 88.20, and the settlement 88.67 and a half, that closing unchanged from today's open. Lean hogs for October had a high today of 73.97 and a half, a low of 72.75, the settlement 73.80, up 180. December lean hogs, 69.97 and a half was the high, the low was 69.10, and the settlement was 69.70, up 87 and a half. February, high today, 68.45, the low 67.75, the settlement 68.35, up 72.5, and April 05 lean hogs had a high today at 65.90, a low of 65.30, the settlement 65.87.5, up 50. And the February frozen pork bellies had a high of 101.85, a low of 99.30, a settlement at 101.22.5, and that contract ended the day up 2.15.
Thank you very much, Jay. We'll be back in just a moment with a look at the forecast.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Gil Roy from Gilroy, California writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I often hear that we're running out of groundwater. Wouldn't it be fairly simple just to make more?"
You'd be surprised. Water grinding machinery hasn't been manufactured in this country since the turn of the century. All the great water grinders are made in West Germany, and you know how expensive the Deutschmark is. The future for low-cost groundwater doesn't look rosy. The Japanese are getting into water grinder manufacturing, but their grinders will be even more expensive than the German ones. For a while, there were some Italian water grinders on the market. They looked great, but they didn't do much. A few Eastern European water grinders were unsuccessfully imported a few years back. They were extremely heavy, crudely made, had very poor yields, but were indestructible.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Doc's Breath and distributed by PRI. To order the Dr. Science Get Smart Kit with CD and Master's Degree Mouse Pad $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Classic Tan and Swimwear, Champaign; Colonial Pantry, Champaign; and Spectrum Consulting in Mattoon. These business partners join the Friends of WILL.